You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 17th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, President Obama comes out strong on gun control. No surprise, the right wing ready for a revolution. Meanwhile, the Republicans at a trust retreat as we speak, contemplating a tactical retreat on the debt ceiling. Will they be able to do it? Highly doubtful. And part of that is the reason for that is revealed in the Republican electoral scheme for national politics. Response to the death of Aaron Swartz, the introduction of Aaron's Law, and more on the incredible prosecutorial overreach in this case. Bus strike in New York City. Michelle Bachmann. Was she under the spell, some type of Svengali, who would not allow her to sleep in the same room as Marcus, her husband? I can't. It's a true story. And Glenn Beck preparing his libertarian commune, fearing for a revolution in this country. And this bizarre story of Mantio, a linebacker with Notre Dame.
I guess that is the easy way to say it.
Yes. It's all over the place. And in this office, I have to say the knowledge of college football is probably unparalleled in its lack anywhere across all media platforms. However, the interesting thing to me, aside from this just being a bizarre story, which I think is, you know, going to end up being, I don't even know where it goes, but it's just sort of another example of the sheer failure of the media to do even the most rudimentary of due diligence. We'll talk about it more later in the program, probably get to it in the better half, because really my lack of knowledge of pro football is unparalleled, I believe. I mean, of college football is unparalleled. My lack of knowledge of pro football is, I think it's in the running, but when it comes to college football, you know, I'm from the Northeast, and, you know, we didn't, just was not the sport to follow. But really just exemplifies just how lazy the mainstream media, and I'm not just talking about sports too, you know, because we got a clip from Charlie Rose on CBS, which I think exemplifies
just sort of how sad that whole thing was. But let's get to the gun control measures. Of course, we'll talk about more about this with Cliff Schechter on the program tomorrow. I just want to start off, though, with this email from a listener. Here's the story behind finding out that former Portland, Oregon Mayor Sam Adams is a listener and hopefully a member of the Majority Report. We don't go and look at member roles in situations like this, just so that you know, because we do. I just think it would be inappropriate, although we will we'll have Michael do it after the show. Just an FYI, he's the first openly gay mayor of Portland, Oregon, but didn't seek re-election last year and has shown up on many Portlandia episodes. My hubby and some friends were at the same Portland restaurant as Adams when he came by their table to say hello to one of the friends. But then my dearest, this being the husband, had consumed two double Johnny Reds, which really opens him up to conversation. This is the part of the email that I'm most proud of, frankly, is that Majority Report listeners know how to have a good time. We don't leave the farm much, in parentheses. So my husband enthusiastically told Adams how much his wife, me, admires him. Then he asked Adams if he knew another Sam and the Majority Report. Adams said he listens to the show daily. Well, appreciate hearing that we have politicians, former and otherwise, listening to the program. So thank you, Farmer Gillian, for that email. Let's go to the gun control measures that President Obama announced yesterday. We had a tech day yesterday, and we were, I think, fairly successful. In addition to cleaning 2 years of dust off of off of Matt's desk, we have hooked up a new feature for live viewers and also for members. And that is now we have high-quality video that is streaming live on our YouTube page, Majority Report Live. That's our YouTube streaming page, as not to be confused with the
You could go to Sam Cedar's channel page, which is just youtube.com/user/Sam Cedar, and it is the current show. Like right now, it's the featured video up top.
Okay, so you can see it live at Sam Cedar's show.
Sam Cedar,
the YouTube, which you can reach through our website, of course. But we are going to now be making available for members video, full-length video of the shows. And so all you need to do is check in. We will put a link on the front page of, and we'll figure out where to put that, actually, maybe in the menu. And members, when you sign in as a member, you can just go and peruse the YouTubes, full on shows. There you go. Constantly giving members more value for their money. Now, as to President Obama's press conference yesterday, and we'll get deeper into this obviously with Cliff Schechter tomorrow, but I want to start with an ad that was cut by the NRA in anticipation of President Obama's, he didn't sign executive orders, he signed executive actions yesterday, which is slightly different. It basically is just commitment as to what they will do, the administration will do. Now, understand that the administration is somewhat limited because much of this must go through Congress. However, there are some aspects of the executive branch where what they're doing can be enhanced. But in the run-up to President Obama's announcement, the NRA, was it the NRA, released one of the most despicable, pathetic, sad, indicative ads one could imagine, bizarre. Let's play this. I think you can get a gist of it. The images aren't quite so important, but the voiceover is. Let's listen to this now.
Are the president's kids more important than yours? Then why is he skeptical about putting armed security in our schools when his kids are protected by armed guards at their school? Mr. Obama demands the wealthy pay their fair share of taxes, but he's just another elitist hypocrite when it comes to a fair share of security, protection for their kids, and gun-free zones for ours.
Now, aside from the liberal use of background music and swishes and swashes in the ad, one thing that is sort of stunning is that I think the NRA is coming out for a more progressive taxation system in this country, which I applaud. Doesn't seem to be in their portfolio. The other is the sheer bizarreness of calling President Obama a hypocrite, because his children, probably there's been no children in the history of this country who have probably received more explicit or implicit death threats. Now, I don't know this for sure, but I got to imagine it's pretty darn close. I find it hard to believe that there would be a president who has received more.
I mean, the nature of being the first kids or first family is a national security issue in and of itself.
Of course.
I mean, it's
of course. Wow. I mean, this is just absurd. And I'm not even sure of the veracity of it. I'm not sure what school the kids go to, but I read a comment from somewhere who apparently went to the same Quaker school that I believe it was President Clinton's daughter. I think it was it
Friends School?
Yes. And I don't know if the Obama kids go to that same school, but apparently there were not armed guards there. The Secret Service really held back quite a bit so as not to interfere with, obviously, what is a Quaker tenet about violence. But this is what we're dealing with here when it comes to the NRA. And they are following a strategy that is not unlike what we're seeing with the Republican Party in general. They are playing more and more to a decreasing in size base of support, and they're going with a deeper connection with those people. They're getting more money, they're getting more polarization, but this is an increasingly smaller group of people, and I think it shows where the NRA is in terms of their development of an entity. They're increasingly becoming like Glenn Beck's audience or Alex Jones' audience. And I have to say that we'll get to what President Obama suggested, but based upon the comments that we got when we talked about Alex Jones on our YouTube, the number of times that I was called Jew fag, maybe not necessarily Jew fag, but in separate comments, there's certainly more reason to be worried about these gun fanatics than the idea of a government blue helmets and the UN taking over in wake of what President Obama has suggested. So there were 23 proposals that President Obama signed off on yesterday, ranging from issuing a presidential memorandum to require federal agencies to make relevant data available to the federal background check system. In other words, there needs to be more sharing of this data across different federal agencies to address any legal barriers in the Affordable Care Act for doctors to ask whether or not, if they have patients who are dealing with mental issues, if they have young kids or whatnot, to ask whether or not there is guns in the household and whether or not there's proper safety being treated with those guns, to actually having an ATF director, which the Senate has prevented from happening for 6 years now. It's been an acting ATF director, for allowing the ATF to use computers and allowing federal agencies to track gun sales, to determine whether or not if an inordinate amount of guns that are being used in crimes come from specific stores that are selling guns and why that's the case. Maximize efforts to prevent gun violence and prosecute gun crime. That doesn't seem so terrifying to me. To allow for the Center for Disease Control to research the causes and prevention of gun violence. to direct the Attorney General to issue a report on the availability and most effective use of gun safety technologies and challenge the private sector to develop innovative technologies. Some people have referred to the idea, if you have, if you require gun owners to own some type of liability insurance, it will incentivize the use of things like biometrics on guns. In other words, you need to use a certain fingerprint on a gun, or you need to have a certain type of gun lock that will allow only a the owner of the gun to use that gun, because we have literally hundreds of thousands of stolen guns that end up obviously in the hands of criminals, almost by definition. It goes on and on. There are also legislative ideas that will require congressional approval. Hard to imagine we're going to see that, but one, I guess, hope springs eternal. Require criminal background checks for all gun sales. Reinstate and strengthen the assault weapon ban. Restore the 10-round limit on ammunition magazines. Protect police by finishing the job of getting rid of armor-piercing bullets. Give law enforcement additional tools. End the freeze on gun violence research. Make our schools safer with more school resource officers and school counselors. Help ensure that young people get the mental health treatment they need. So there's a wide-ranging number of proposals on the table. Experts, according to Brad Plumer at Washington Post, suggest that there are about five that really could have a demonstrable effect. Universal background checks could have a large impact on gun crime. Experts say that, you know, as you know, about 40% of sales now are not subject to a background check. Experts say anything that can add friction to that secondary market could prove very helpful. Giving federal law enforcement more power to trace guns. Like I said, the ATF has a limited ability to share its data on where guns actually come from, and it can't keep computerized records. What's more, not all federal agencies are required to trace all guns they've recovered. Few of the proposals would do much to help with the problem of stolen guns. About a million guns are stolen each year. However, Congress could go further by requiring mandatory gun insurance. Again, what I mentioned there, the notion of having genuine liability as to where your gun ends up may increase the use of mechanisms that prevent non-owners from using guns. I imagine this would also be safe for kids in a house who accidentally find guns that haven't been locked up properly. Experts tend to be more skeptical about the assault weapons ban. We've seen in the past, assault weapon bans are easily skirted. However, maybe there's ways of making them a little bit more rigid. Certainly in New York, they're now, I believe they banned a lot of semi-automatic weapons, the future sales, and if you own one, you need to register that again in as a automatic weapon. And the fifth considered most relevant would be the restriction on federal funding for gun research. In 96, Congress passed a law that prohibited federal funding for research that, quote, advocates or promotes gun control. Of course, if you find that there are major loopholes in the way that guns are sold or background checks, then presumably you could fall under that restriction that it would in some way advocate for gun control. This is obviously a very broad piece of legislation, and it has prevented the CDC from going forward with studying any of the causes and effects of gun violence and of our gun control regime as it stands now. So those are some of the biggest highlights. Tomorrow we will talk to Cliff Schechter about this more, but like I say, some of the major parts of this are going to be about legislation coming from Congress, and this is going to provide a showdown. I think one of the things that are going to be really interesting is, and we'll talk more to Cliff about this, but the real issue here is seeing guns now as a social issue. This is another step that President Obama has taken on social issues that I think comports with what he's done in these other areas, both in terms of choice and the issue of abortion for women and marriage equality. We'll talk more about this with Cliff tomorrow, because I think this has it's an interesting dynamic that's taking place at the White House. And as we go to as we start to talk about the debt ceiling fight, which and the sequester fight and the continuing resolution fight, which, of course, because Congress has refused to pass a budget, all they do is basically pass a continuing resolution to forward the existing budget that I think now we're like on our third or fourth one at this point, with, of course, the automatic cuts that have been imposed, which is, in other words, a budget. So we hear often the Republicans say, President Obama's never passed a budget. Well, of course we have a budget. It's just that it's not been done through the traditional process because Republicans are so insane. And all of this, all of the questions that are coming up in terms of the deficit, all of the questions are going to be coming up in terms of the sequester fight. Now, understand that on March 1st, there will be automatic cuts imposed on discretionary domestic spending, just about everything aside from Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and somewhere around 12% across the board, reaching around $500, $600 billion over the course of 10 years. A nearly equal amount imposed on defense spending. What we're going to see on day one, or at least starting on day one, in terms of domestic spending, will be cuts in government services that virtually all Americans use on a daily basis, whether it's the FAA, whether it's the FDA, whether it's about building infrastructure. It will be pain and lack of services that most Americans will feel very quickly. And as they start to realize that it's going to take longer for airplanes to take off, or safety will be traded off, that food safety will diminish. I mean, on and on and on across the board. And that's important to note as we enter into this period, because we're going to be hearing a lot more about it in the coming weeks and months. Because the fight is going to come down in terms of progressives and liberals, and in terms of the deal that Democrats end up cutting with the Republicans, between the idea of pushing these cuts into the future on Medicare and Social Security in a way that is incredibly insidious, and in a way that has far less accountability, and particularly in terms of political implications, as opposed to cuts that Americans are going to feel now and be able to point to what is happening in Washington to what is happening on a local level in terms of the services they expect. This is important, because this is what the political fight is going to boil down to, at least amongst Democrats and amongst progressives and liberals. On the other hand, the Republicans, they don't want cuts to defense because this is their bread and butter, the military-industrial complex, which is not to say that it's not the bread for Democrats. It's just not the bread and butter. Or maybe it's just the butter for Democrats. But part of this, part of how this will shake out, as we start to hear of Republicans having to go on trust retreats with each other, God knows what they're doing on this retreat. But as they go on a retreat to plan their strategy in terms of dealing with the debt ceiling, and the numbers coming out now in terms of polls as to the implications of defaulting on our debt and what it will do to the American economy, what it will do to the world economy, what it will do to government services is not looking terribly good for Republicans. And so what do you do when you've promised your base that you're going to vote one way and the rest of the country and your taskmasters on Wall Street or in industry are telling you to vote the other way? Well, you go on a trust retreat. But why do they have this problem? I think it can be revealed in what is getting a lot more attention now. I think Rachel Maddow did a story on it. Maybe it was last night. Maybe it was the other day. I'm not sure. But this was a story I touched upon back in December briefly when it was clear that the Republicans had an agenda to do this. And I'm speaking about the Republican agenda to change the way that electoral votes are awarded to candidates in presidential elections, specifically in states that were considered swing states, but have basically moved in, at least in the context of presidential politics, into the fairly or lean towards Democrats column, if you could. Back on December 17th, Reed Wilson of the National Journal wrote that senior Republicans say they will try to leverage their party's majorities in Democratic-leaning states in an effort to end the winner-take-all system of awarding electoral votes. Remember, the context for this. There are many states which Republicans took control of the state legislatures in 2010. In addition to passing things like right-to-work, so-called right-to-work legislation, in addition to trying to pass and passing in some instances a whole host of anti-choice legislation, in addition to passing bat-crap crazy things like, you know, we have to say God in school 43 times or whatever it is, outlaw books that look at critical reasoning, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that they also did, based upon the 2010 census that came out after these elections, was to redistrict a lot of congressional seats and essentially gerrymandered things so much that a lot of Democratic votes were isolated, particularly in urban districts. And the strangest sort of outlines of Republican districts were drawn so that Republicans could get a lock on these seats. There were 1 million more votes cast for Democratic congressional candidates in 2012 than Republicans. However, Republicans won 33 more seats than Democrats. Conceptually, this is sort of a difficult thing to wrap your head around. But the fact is those seats that were won by Democrats were won overwhelmingly because there were so many Democrats isolated in Democratic districts, whereas these Republicans won closer to 60-40, let's say, or 55-45, which is a pretty big win because the Democrats were siphoned off essentially into oddly contiguous districts because they were drawn so strangely. So the implications are not just on a congressional level. And many experts, and I think I'm not counting myself as one, but I've certainly repeated this on the past on the show, believe that Democrats really have no chance because of the way these districts are drawn to win the House until the 2020 census is taken, and they have an opportunity perhaps to take back some of these state legislatures and redraw these districts. There are some legislation that are being proposed to impose nonpartisan redistricting, but I don't know that's going to go anywhere. So the plan is by Republicans in states like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Virginia, perhaps Ohio and Florida, is to, instead of awarding electoral votes based upon how the state votes in terms of a popular vote, they will award it based upon how congressional districts vote. So, in other words, if you're in Michigan, and I'm just making up numbers here because I don't have them, and people have done this breakdown. But if you're in Michigan and the president wins by the popular vote in Michigan by 3-4 percentage points, however, loses, or let's take Pennsylvania, for instance, because I know this off the top of my head. Pennsylvania, he wins by 3-4 percentage points, popular vote. However, Democrats lost congressional districts there, I think 13-5, somewhere around that neighborhood. What they would do in Pennsylvania, for instance, is award the electoral votes based on the congressional districts. This is, in some respects, a reflection of the way that we do the electoral vote, where Al Gore could win 500,000 more votes nationally, but lose because the electoral votes were handed out based on a state-by-state basis. It diminishes the power of cities, urban areas. It diminishes the power of places where there is a strong concentration of, like, New York and California, of Democratic voters based upon simply by the fact that they live in New York and California. Fundamentally, the electoral vote in and of itself is anti-democratic. There has been a strong push for a national popular vote in this country, and it is, to a certain extent, picking up steam as different state legislatures around the country vote for it. We're still not there yet. But what it would do, the implications of this, if they were to be able to, Republicans who control state legislatures in states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, Virginia, and Florida do, it would essentially have taken the landslide in electoral votes that President Obama won in this past election, and it would have made Mitt Romney the winner of the 2012 election. Those are the stakes that are involved here. So a Republican Party that sees its diminished national prestige as a reality realizes we have to change the way that we vote for president in key states that are electing Democrats to the presidency. And this has implications, or I should say, this is a reflection of what is driving the Republican Party now, too, which is that their electoral strength is highly concentrated in regions within states and also regionally in the country. They are playing more and more to a decreasing base, but because of its concentration, that's where they're getting their power. And I've spoken about the misalignment of incentives of between what you could call national Republican leadership and members of Congress. And this is why some people are speculating that when we talk about the threat of default, even though the Republican Party as a whole is getting a lot of pressure from places like Wall Street, from even Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers back thing, who were saying, you know, this default thing is okay. Yeah, we get it, but we really don't want to do this. The capacities for these national groups and these national constituencies, the big money, to influence congressional Republicans is diminished now on issues like this, because the Republican base who have sent these congressmen to the House, they've drunk the Kool-Aid. They think a national debt default is no big deal. They think this is what we need to do because, well, I mean, they're ignorant and they are radical in some respects. And that's why you're going to see a split between the Senate Republicans on this issue and the House Republicans, because the Senate Republicans still have to run in states that have, I should say, only a minority of fanatics. They cannot afford to be that far to the right. Now, many of them are afraid of getting primaried, which is really the biggest threat that a Senate Republican has, that they're going to get primaried to the right, because then you're only playing on the playing field of the lunatic fringe, i.e. the Republican base. That is why you see people like Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch go down in flames, at least in this cycle. There was others in the cycle prior. And so the debt ceiling issue is one in which we could see the Republicans essentially vote against. Now, there's a question as to whether or not that so-called Hastert rule will apply. And it'll be an interesting litmus test to see if it's important. But it seems impossible that Bonaire will not bring this up for a vote, in which case you'll get more Democrats who will vote to raise the debt ceiling limit. But we shall see. I have to say that I think President Obama, based upon his press conference on Tuesday, is at the very least indicating, and I should remind everybody we've got to trust but verify on this situation, because we've heard him say this before, that he's not negotiating on it, and he's going to wrap this around the Republicans' necks if they actually plunge our economy into some type of catastrophic event. As to the other issue, we'll be talking about this more in the weeks to come, but that will push the real debate onto how to forestall the sequester, the automatic cuts that were imposed because of the last debt ceiling fight. You'll recall the last debt ceiling fight created the super committee that was supposed to come up with a way of closing the deficit by $1.2 trillion, or come up with better cuts worth $1.2 trillion. They couldn't, so the sequester kicked in automatically. Now, it's quite possible the deal could be just let's kick it down the can down the road another 3 months, and then another 3 months, and then another, 6 months, year, whatnot. There is legitimate concern that the president will take the posture that we must negotiate with the Republicans to limit the cuts to discretionary spending, and do so by cutting Social Security benefits, Medicare benefits in one shape or another. That is going to be the big fight on the left. The leverage supposedly that Republicans have is that we would be facing 12% of domestic cuts across the board. The leverage that Democrats have is that Republicans really don't want to cut defense. And so those will be where the lines are drawn. But before, we will talk about that. We'll have plenty of time to talk about that in the coming months. But like I said, I think it's the Hill's reporting that House Republican leaders are weighing several options for legislation that would combine an increase in the debt ceiling with cuts to federal spending as they attempt to coalesce this around a strategy at the annual House GOP retreat, which begins in Wednesday. That would be yesterday in Williamsburg, Virginia. And it remains to be seen what they're going to how they're going to approach this. But they're clearly on their heels right now. But with that said, really good piece by Matt Iglesias on why there is such fanaticism amongst the villagers, the establishment in this country, to cut to cut Social Security. He says the important people capitalized, so that you know he's talking about a specific subset of people in our society, the establishment, absolutely despise Social Security. And he says that there's a deep logic to their hatred. You have to appreciate not just the existence of the hatred, but its source to understand the game being played here. It goes way deeper than the fact that lots of people don't like taxes and thus don't like spending that leads to taxes. It is that Social Security is special and especially despised because lots of important people care a lot about the economy. He capitalizes that as well. He says the economy consists of adding up all the economically valuable stuff that happens. And with most government spending, you can make some kind of case that the spending boosts the economy. The economy wants you to spend money on things that can be plausibly described as investments that drive future prosperity. That can include education. That can include government services. That could include food safety, infrastructure, whatnot. However, mailing a check to your grandma does not fit the bill. He writes, you've got this big scheme to levy taxes on working people who are participating in the economy and transfer money to people who've dropped out of the economy. In other words, retirees. They take that money and use it to pay the electricity bill and buy a cookie for their grandkids. But if they didn't get that money, they'd probably have to work longer and spend more years being part of the economy. They'd have to spend their working years being thriftier and amassing more savings via the magic of the financial system. Finance private sector investments in the economy. The economy thrives on incentives. If you work, we'll give you money. And in desperation, if you want money, you have to work. And Social Security is a double whammy. Reducing the incentive of workers and reducing the desperation of the elderly. The important thing to note about this hatred, it is not that it's not unjustified. The haters aren't wrong. Retired people don't boost the economy. Trimming their cost of living adjustments does. The more you trim, the more boost you get. Doing the reverse of Social Security and saying that everyone over the age of 65 has to write a check to the government or be turned into Soylent Green would boost the economy even more. Because that money that you save from, basically steal from workers' wages on some level, frankly, that money that you save from, you know, forcing grandma essentially to eat less food or keep the temperature down at 63 instead of 67 or 8 in her apartment, or that she can go out to see a movie. All of that money supposedly will get into the economy more if it is not with retired people. This is the source, he says, of their hatred of Social Security. And I think all you need to do is look at that rich guy, that old coot, Alan Simpson, who doesn't rely on Social Security to live his luxurious life. In fact, he relies on saying that we should cut it now at $40,000 a pop for a speaking engagement. He relies on that. But that's why he describes these people as teeth suckers. And is stealing money from young people. And as parasites. Because the idea of retired people living with some shred of dignity, if they can't command $40,000 a speaking engagement to call for the cuts to their life, is an anathema to him. He hates it because, of course, it's not what he does. Which is why, of course, you only see either young people who think that they won't need Social Security, who have been listening to Simpson, whether he appears on Jon Stewart's show or does some dumb Gingham-style dance, and rich people call for cuts to Social Security. And then you've got the rest of the country, the 80%, who basically say, don't cut our Social Security. Cut defense. Raise the cap on Social Security taxes, whatever. We don't want cuts. We don't want cuts to Social Security, and we don't want cuts to Medicare. Save that money off of other people's backs, people who don't need that money. And that's going to play a big part in these negotiations that are coming up. And it's arguably going to be the, well, it may not be the last of these battles. So there's an argument it's going to be the biggest, most important argument of the next at least 2 years. We could see it happen again, which would make it less so. But it's one that you should be aware of the context in which this is being fought. All right, folks. That is our show for today. We will, of course, we have the members half coming up now. You can become a member of this program by going to majority.fm. Clicking on Become a Member. It is your memberships. I know it's the beginning of the year. I know everybody's budgets are tight. If you can afford to do so, please do so. We're not looking at a big net positive for January in terms of memberships. And we need your support. If you can afford to and you enjoy this program, please become a member today. There are other ways of supporting the show, like giving us a good review on iTunes. That's free. If you buy junk through Amazon, buying through our Amazon link at majority.fm, just go there. It takes you 2 seconds. Go to majority.fm, click support the show, click Amazon, bookmark that, keep that on your bookmarks as your Amazon link. You have to do nothing else. The whole thing will take you about literally 2 minutes. And, buying coffee from justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. We are, we could really use your support. In the coming weeks, and maybe a month and a half, and I don't know, we're still trying to figure out what I'm going to do when my kid comes. I will be taking a little bit of paternity leave. I don't know if I'll like do like, I don't know. I don't know what I'll do for paternity leave. I mean, I assume I'll take a week or two off, maybe.
The Majority Report with Matt Binder and Michael Brooks?
It's possible.
That is a really excellent idea.
Boom. I'm not sure about that. Maybe we'll do.
We could just wire you up
in the maternity ward, yeah. Listen to you kvetch for a week.
Yeah, that's
possible.
That
could be entertaining.
Our Occupy anniversary coverage that me and Michael did without you was given rave reviews.
That's true. All right, maybe we'll try that, but we will see. all right, folks, we'll see you in the better half. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. We will be back in just a moment. You can IM me at Majority FM. Hello? Matt? Do you need help?
Yeah.
That is not a resounding endorsement for you to take over the show when I'm gone. You can't even hit the
music. For some reason, that one button on soundboard won't work. Give me a second.
All right, here we go.
You got it?
Yep.
So we take one. La poupée qu'il fait non.
Fuck off.
I give her my love, she says no. Says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're
If I ask her to walk with me, she shakes her head. She's a pretty little doll who says no, no, no. All the night time through, she says no, 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 no. If I ask her to walk with me, why can't she ever say? Ask her to walk.